Listen carefully. My beloved, I love you. You're my people. I see you. I see you there. I see every single one of you. I know what's in your heart. I know what you're going through. I know the hurts. I know the pains. I know the disappointments. I know the tragedies. I know the joys. I know the peace. I know the love and the intimacy with me that you long for. You've been singing about it this morning, but I want to enfold my arms around you. I want to minister to you this very moment, this very, very moment. Lay your burdens at the foot of Jesus. He paid the price that you don't need to carry them. I love you, my beloved. I love you. Some of you are wondering how you know that I love you. I'm telling you now, I love you. I love you with an undying love. I came to earth. I died for you. I bought you with a price, my own blood. Receive my love this morning. No, you are special in my sight, every single one of you. My word says that I know every sparrow that falls. I know everything about every single one of you. And I still love you. Because I bought you with a price. You're mine. You're mine. You're mine. You're mine, says Father. You're mine. Get it into your hearts. Get it deep within your hearts. You belong to me. I pay the price.
Good morning, everyone. Let's just begin in prayer. Dear Father, we give this morning to you. Open our hearts, eyes, and ears to hear you today. May my words be your words this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. It's that time of year again. Schools have either broken up or they're about to. And there will have been many end-of-term plays, parents' evenings, school reports, and sports days. Many prizes will have been awarded, whether it was for running races or relays or egg and spoon or long jump, high jump. I wonder if you've been to any, or if you've ever won a prize for any of them. And of course, over the past week, there have been other prizes won, pretty big ones, in football and in tennis. And I'm sure many of us will have watched some of those matches too. Well, one of the most prestigious prizes awarded every year is the Nobel Peace Prize. I'd like to talk very briefly about someone who achieved this accolade. It's a young girl who many of you will remember. Her name is Malala. She was born in Pakistan in 1997. Malala loved school. But one day everything changed when the Taliban took control of her town. They banned many things and enforced harsh punishments on those who defied their orders. And they said girls could no longer go to school. But Malala continued going and encouraged her school friends to go and even spoke out publicly on behalf of girls and their right to learn. And this made her a target for the Taliban. One day, a masked gunman boarded her school bus and asked, "Who is Malala?" She rose, and he shot her in the head. She woke up 10 days later in a hospital in Birmingham, England. and after months of surgery and rehabilitation, she rejoined her family in their new home in the UK. But she determined to continue to speak out for girls having the opportunity to go to school. And in 2014, Malala was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. She was 17 years old. Since then, she's graduated from the University of Oxford and is committed to fight for girls' education worldwide. Malala says, "I don't want to be remembered as the girl who was shot. I want to be remembered as the girl who stood up." She stood up against a terrifying opponent, and in different parts of the world, there are many today trying to stand up against oppressive regimes. And all through history, we can see the bravery of so many people. And when we look in the Old Testament, we read about many courageous characters who, because of their faith in God, stood up against formidable enemies. Joseph, Daniel, Gideon, David, that's just a few of them. But this morning, I'd like to look at five brave women in the Bible, although technically one of them is too young to be called a woman. But I've included her because she has a very important part to play in the story. All these five women were crucial to the birth and survival of a baby boy. So my title this morning is Five Women and a Baby. We'll be looking in particular at the first two chapters of Exodus. And to try and place this story into context, we need to very briefly consider the events which led up to it. Exodus, the second book in the Bible, continues the storyline from the previous book, Genesis. And Genesis ended with Abraham's grandson, Jacob, leading his large family from Canaan down to Egypt because of famine in their land. And in Egypt, Jacob's son, Joseph, had been elevated to second in command over all Egypt. So because of that, the family enjoyed a safe, respected place in society. Joseph's family thrived and grew, became known as the Israelites, and lived in an area of Egypt for several generations. And if we fast forward about 400 years, we find that the Israelites are growing into a massive population. In Exodus chapter 1, it tells us that the land of Egypt was filled with them. Let's just look at verses 8 to 10. "Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. 'Look,' he said to his people, 'the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country.'" So this new king, Pharaoh, feels under no obligation at all to continue to provide the Israelites with the safety that previous leaders have given them. He sees his kingdom has a large number of Israelites, and he becomes exceedingly worried that they'll overtake his land and destroy him. However, at the same time, he's also fearful that they will leave because he needs them to contribute to the economy of the land. And his fear leads to an oppressive condition of forced labor. And he puts slave masters over the Israelites and works them more and more mercilessly. And in verses 12 to 13, we read, "But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly." So now the king's fear, or paranoia really, has spread to the Egyptian people. And they in turn heightened their cruelty to the Israelites. But despite the appallingly harsh conditions they live in, the Israelites keep increasing in number. So the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, has to think of a different plan. And verses 15 to 16 tell us what he does. "The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shifra and Pua, 'When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. And if it is a girl, let her live. And there is the mention of our first two women, Shiphrah and Puah. The king's plan now is to deviously bring about the death of boy babies at the time of their delivery, and he wants it done speedily and quietly, and to carry out this plan, he requires the help of the midwives, Shiphrah and Puah. Now, Shiphrah and Puah were probably two senior midwives who would oversee the other midwives helping the Israelite women to give birth. They probably didn't have any children of their own, and this is mentioned a bit later on. And their names, though, are recorded here in the Bible. No male elders are named, and neither is the Pharaoh. But these two women are, which means they were significant. What would they have been feeling to be told to carry out this horrific order to murder newborn boys? They would have known that to disobey would lead to harsh penalties, maybe even death. So what did Shiphrah and Puah decide to do? Verse 17 tells us, the midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Now, you would perhaps think that in the middle of all the threats and the violence that they were witnessing towards their own people, their fear would be of the Egyptian king. But they feared God instead. And in this particular context, to fear God didn't mean being afraid of him. It's a reverence for his authority. And for these two women, it was an acknowledgement that God was the true king, not Pharaoh. Shiphrah and Puah had faith that God is greater than any human power, and they chose to act not out of fear of the Pharaoh, but out of their deep reverence for God. They displayed immense courage and had faith that God would not abandon them, and they chose to oppose the king. Now, there's probably a period of time before the king realized his plan wasn't really working, because he kept seeing lots of little Hebrew boys running around. And he needed answers. So verses 18 to 19 tell us what happened next. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. Really? Well, maybe Shiphrah and Puah alerted the Israelite women to what Pharaoh was trying to do. So perhaps they didn't call them until it was much later on. We don't know. All we do know is that they thwarted Pharaoh's plans, and God was pleased with them, because verse 20 then tells us, so God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. So because of Shiphrah and Puah's faith and courage, God's blessings are poured out on all the Israelites and on them. And these two women had risked their lives to do what was right, instead of acting out of fear of Pharaoh and their own safety. Their courage and defiance against evil began a sequence of events that led to God rescuing his people. You need courage to stand up to such a brutal and powerful oppressor, because there's always the fear of reprisal, and there is reprisal, but in a different way. Pharaoh gives up on the midwives, but his plans of genocide remain. And verse 22 tells us his next step. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the river Nile, but let every girl live. So, Pharaoh is now commanding all the Egyptians to take responsibility for killing the baby boys. He's giving them permission to do this terrible act. Now, we know that the Egyptians worshipped the river Nile, so they may have considered it an act of sacrifice to their gods, but even so, it was an incredible edict to pass. And there's now even greater oppression for the Israelites, and all hope seems lost. But God is going to use more women to change the course of history. story now turns to a specific Israelite couple and the introduction of our third woman. At this point, the couple are not named, but they marry and have a son. And in Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, it tells us, "Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months." It's not until chapter 6 that we discover the couple's names. The man is Amram and his wife is Jochebed. So here's our third woman, Jochebed. Just imagine the inner conflict she must be facing when she realizes she's pregnant. Will the child be a girl or a boy? What will happen if it's a boy? For 9 months she has that uncertainty. And when she does give birth, it is indeed to a boy. And he's later named Moses. Jochebed knew his chances of survival were poor. Maybe she'd watched other mothers having their baby sons taken away from them and drowned. But the text tells us, when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. And it's also mentioned in other places in the Bible. In Acts 7, verse 20, we read, "Moses was born and he was no ordinary child." Hebrews 11, verse 23 says, "Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child." And now the powerful bonds and love of a mother inspire Jochebed to protect her son and hide him. And for a while she did so successfully. But of course, as her baby grew, it became increasingly difficult. He became more active, more noisy, and she had to come up with a new plan. And we can read about it in verse 3. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. What a creative, daring idea to try and keep her son alive. But it must have been terrifying. Did she make the basket waterproof enough? Will it gradually sink? Will her son be killed by crocodiles? She had no idea what would happen next, but she was entrusting her son to God. What courage, what faith. In the next verse, we're introduced to our fourth woman, although at the time she was only a young girl. Verse 4 says, "His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him." And now we discover that the baby boy has a sister. It's not until chapter 15 that we find out her name is Miriam. She's been given the responsibility of surreptitiously keeping an eye on her baby brother. And verses 5 to 6 tell us what happened and also introduce us to our fifth woman. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. So now the baby is in the hands of the enemy, an Egyptian. And not just any Egyptian, the daughter of the Pharaoh. What would she do? She has a choice to make. And the Bible tells us, amazingly, she has compassion for the baby. Her heart is stirred by looking at him and hearing his cries. And all this time, the baby's sister is watching. She sees her brother in the hands of the Egyptian princess. And now she jumps into action with a brilliant suggestion. And verse 7 reads, "Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, 'Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?' Now, although young, his sister knows that this is a time is of the essence. She needs to move fast. Her leadership skills are already in existence, and she confidently approaches the Egyptian princess with the offer to find a nursemaid for the child, clearly having her mother in mind. She's brave, smart, and astute. And verses 8 to 10 tell us the princess's response. "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." Well, imagine the scene. Miriam has just watched the Egyptian princess find her baby's brother, that's the word I want, thank you. She rushes home, she calls to her mother, "Come with me, you won't believe what's just been happening." And Jochebed rushes to the river and is now brought face to face with the Egyptian princess who wants her to nurse the baby. And she's actually going to be paid for it, paid for looking after her own son. The son she entrusted to the Lord is now safe. Jochebed must have been overjoyed. But there is a condition. The princess said, "Nurse him for me." Jochebed realizes that in order to allow her son to live, the princess is going to have to become his adoptive mother. And as we read, once he was no longer nursing, at that time, maybe between the ages of 2 to 4 in that culture, Jochebed had to bring him to live with Pharaoh's daughter. And it was Pharaoh's daughter who named him Moses. Jochebed had to say goodbye to him. The outcome was not without heartache or loss. It's such a well-known story, and it's been told with an emphasis on women. But let's just remind us of them. Shiphrah and Puah, the midwives. Jochebed, the mother. Miriam, the daughter. And the Egyptian princess, Pharaoh's daughter. Although familiar, there are certain aspects which I'd like us to think about. How good are we taking responsibility for our actions? These five women are great examples of doing just that. But here are some what-if scenarios to consider. What if, when the king commanded Shiphrah and Puah to kill all the baby boys as they were being born, their response had been, "Well, he's our boss. He's not just any boss, he's the king. So we have to do what he says. After all, there's only two of us. We can't disobey him. He's far more powerful than we are. Apart from anything else, he could do something terrible to us if we don't agree to do what he says." They could have done that, but they didn't. Instead, they got together and agreed that despite all the risks involved, they would disobey him. And indeed, for a while it seemed as if their plan was successful, until the day when they were summoned again to a very angry, fierce Pharaoh to explain their actions. How did they feel then? Did they crack under the pressure? Did they prepare for the worst? No, they had some creative thinking to do, and fast. And when they gave their highly dubious answer about the vigorous birthing techniques of the Hebrew women, amazingly, it seemed to satisfy the king. However, we knew that there were reprisals, and now that gives us another what if. What if, having given birth to a baby boy, Jochebed had decided, "Well, it's a boy, he won't survive long, I can't protect him. He'll be discovered and thrown into the Nile. There's nothing I can do. It's not the Pharaoh's, it's not my fault, it's the Pharaoh's. I've seen it happen so many times to all the other women around here." She could have done that, but she didn't. She decided on a plan. She hid him, at first in a home, and then when that became too dangerous, Jochebed put out her next brave idea into action and hid her son in a basket in the reeds of the River Nile. Which leads to another, what if? What if, when Jochebed asked her young daughter to watch and see what happens to her little brother, she had said, "Oh, I can't do that. I'm too young and it's too dangerous and I wouldn't know what to do if something happened to him." She could have said that, but she didn't. And despite her young age, she didn't hesitate to take on the responsibility and then speedily think up an incredible solution so her brother could remain safe. And then the final what if. What if, when the princess found the baby boy in the River Nile, she'd said, "It's sad, but I can't possibly help this child. My father's a pharaoh. He has decreed that all baby Hebrew boys must die. I can't go against his command. What would he do to me?" I have no choice. Besides, what would everyone in the palace think of me? She could have said that, but she didn't. Even Pharaoh's own daughter defied his orders. And unbeknown to her, she enabled her adopted son Moses to grow into his destiny. All five of them took responsibility themselves. They didn't blame or make excuses. They took action instead. These women were no wilting wallflowers. They didn't make a noise about it, but they were not pushovers. They weren't submissive in the face of danger or in the face of evil. They didn't know what the consequences of their actions would be. They didn't know if it would end in life or death. Their actions weren't influenced by any promise of fame or fortune, just a desire to nurture life, and they were willing to risk everything for it. And it's tempting to think of them as the fearless five, but of course that wouldn't be true. They had fear, they had it in abundance. They just didn't allow it to control them. They didn't allow their circumstances to overwhelm them into defeat and paralysis. And if you think about it, God went to extraordinary lengths to bring about Moses into the world and thus ensure the deliverance of Israel. But it wasn't an easy journey. This was a time of incredible oppression. Things seemed to go from bad to worse for the Israelites, and God didn't take away the problems they faced. He didn't just zap the Pharaoh to make things easier. It's changed for us today. We still all face different problems and have challenges that we have to go through, which more likely than not, we don't really want to. And there's the temptation to think that when things get worse, God's absent. And for the Israelites, God seemed silent. There seemed to be no reason why they suffered years and years of pain, anguish and loss. And they must have wondered, God, are you listening? We're suffering. Where are you? Have you turned away? Have you forgotten us? And sometimes our lives can be like that. Experiences without any explanations. But this event in Exodus teaches us that God is there. Behind the scenes, God is doing something. We want quick, simple solutions to our problems. We're very used to getting things done fast, click of a button. But we know that God doesn't work like that. We may tend to think, well, God, if you do it my way, there's a song, this problem will be sorted speedily. But God has reasons we know nothing about. Think back to Jochebed. As she was handing over her child to the Pharaoh's daughter, did she think, Lord, surely you don't want my son to be brought up by our enemies, by people who don't even know you. But this was all part of God's plan for Moses. There were reasons, but they didn't become evident until many years later. So what has all this to do with us? How is it relevant to us today? Well, perhaps it may prompt us to consider our own answers to these questions. Are we ready to take responsibility ourselves when really we'd rather turn away or blame the other people or circumstances or simply leave decision making to someone else, which is a decision in itself? Are we ready to be courageous in the face of fear or intimidation when we don't feel it? We're terrified and we have no idea of the outcome. Are we ready to persevere when circumstances affecting our lives become so tough we're tempted to just give up, hide under the duvet, or run away? Are we ready to patiently await God's timing when we are straining at the leash for things to change and we want to take action into our own hands? God's plans for our lives are not just for us, but for others. It's the legacy that we leave. I don't know about you, but personally, I find those questions extremely challenging. There are real situations that we all face sometimes in our lives. And the five women in our story all faced them. Wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a simple solution? Well, there is, but it's not always necessarily an easy one. It's a one-word answer: trust. In our lives, God may be doing something we just don't understand. And that's when we need to trust that he knows exactly what he's doing. He's at work in the mundane as well as in the details. His plans are accurate. His timing is perfect. God is in control. And finally, in the words of 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, it sums it up. For God has not given us a spirit of fear and timidity, but of power, love, and self-discipline. For God has not given us a spirit of fear and timidity, but of power, love, and self-discipline. What a verse to stand on. Let's remind ourselves of it during the coming week.